I'm excited to bring you the 69th episode of the Fisheries Podcast, where I talk to Lang Solberg, a commercial fisherman in the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery. We have an incredibly wide-ranging conversation about fish, fishermen, fisheries policy, Alaska, parenting, and much, much more. Joining me, I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head over to patreon.com and search for Fisheries Podcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. We're very grateful for our three patrons so far and hope you consider joining them. We're excited to announce that Nick Kramer will be rejoining the show as a consistent host, so we'll be returning to weekly episodes of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to be a guest, please get in touch. Finally, we enjoyed hearing from you during our Voices of Quarantine episode and would love to make your stories a recurring part of the show. If you have a story to tell, particularly a major win or fail in fishery science, send an email with a voice memo to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. We'd love to put you on. This week's guest is Lang Solberg. He's an entrepreneur, writer, consultant, and fisherman. He recently completed his master's degree in marine affairs at the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington. His research focused on using a statistical model to determine whether a 2004 regulation change in the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery significantly impacted limited entry salmon permit values in subsequent years. In June of 2019, Lang wrapped up two consecutive terms as a director and the treasurer of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. He skippers a commercial salmon vessel in Alaska and manages North American business development for Real-Time Data's Deckhand electronic logbook platform. Founded in Adelaide, Australia, Real-Time Data has developed groundbreaking logbook software and data management tools to empower fishermen worldwide in the collection of their own high-resolution data. Welcome to the podcast, Lang.
Thank you, Julie. Nice to be here.
I'm pretty excited to talk to you. This is a little bit of an out-of-the-box conversation. We don't often get to have the chance to talk to real commercial fishermen here on the Fisheries Podcast. I feel like we should do that a lot more often, but it ends up being a sort of insular sciencey world. So I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
I'm excited as well. And I think that commercial fishermen largely need to talk to scientists more. So it goes both ways.
So it seems from your bio and your resume that I saw that you have been a Washingtonian your whole life.
Yeah, proud Washingtonian my whole life. I was born and raised in Bellingham, Washington. One of the gateways to the San Juan Islands and the lower mainland in Canada, and of course Alaska. The Alaska Ferry leaving out of Bellingham, usually when the state of Alaska budget is in good enough shape. The state ferry leaves Bellingham every Friday night, bound for Ketchikan, so you can hop on board and head north. I think it's 36 hours-ish to Ketchikan, and Ketchikan is the first stop, and then it hops up through Wrangell, Petersburg, Juneau, Haines, Skagway, Sitka, and then back again. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I've wanted to take that ride for so long. I just have never gotten back over there to do it. What's your first memory of the ocean, living right next to it pretty much your whole life?
I like, nobody's asked me that question for as long as I can remember, if ever, and I'm really glad you asked it. My first memory of the ocean out here is when I would go out and quote-unquote fish as a four-year-old or six-year-old or whatever with my dad in the San Juan Islands. He had two vessels down here based in Bellingham, jointly owned with my grandfather at the time, and that's when salmon fishing in the San Juans in Puget Sound was a bit more prolific. I would go out and spend nights fishing for kings and sockeye and with him, and my mom would join us every once in a while. But it's those sights and smells and sounds from those early memories on the water that ultimately, I think, sealed my destiny.
That actually leapt out at me too, that you're a third generation commercial fisherman.
Salmon crashed from mostly a biological perspective in Washington State here back when I was a kid, maybe in my early teens. It was really kind of a time to sell out of the fishery if you indeed thought you could pull it off and move on and get your permit and your boat sold. And my dad was one of the people who did that. Now people still fish for chums and some sockeye and some kings out here. But it's not like it used to be. My dad also sold out of other fisheries he was involved in for some business reasons, but also for the fact that he was gone nearly year round. I think as he saw me start to get more active as a kid and grow up, he wanted to see more of that, didn't want to miss it. So he sold out of the San Francisco herring fishery, as well as Southeast Alaska herring and salmon, and whittled our fishing investment as a family down to the Bristol Bay sockeye fishery, which is still an amazing, pristine resource that affords us the opportunity to harvest that resource. Our eggs are in that basket, and my grandfather was the original recipient, our first limited entry permit for that fishery back in the mid-70s when the state of Alaska moved to a limited entry system, and that permit has been passed down to me now. And I've reinvested with a new boat. I married a fisherman. My wife is a fisherman. She fishes with her dad. So, you know, it's like, it's game on here. We're either on the water or we're talking about it, or we're working in our day jobs to make the world a better place on the water. So.
Yeah. I'm actually married to a fisheries biologist as well. So
okay.
Yep. We talk work all the time.
Yep. Yep.
When did you start fishing commercially yourself?
Aside from those early memories when I was a kid, where I was, quote, fishing, but really just hanging out in my life jacket with the crotch strap, trying not to go overboard. So that aside, I started fishing at age 12. I went to Bristol Bay for the first time when I was 12 years old to try and take a stab at filling some pretty big shoes that were left behind by my late uncle, who fished with my dad. It was my dad's brother. He passed away way too young after a battle with cancer. And when he passed away, it was a big hit to the family, of course, and the community. But my dad was down a crew member and I was 12, and he looked at me and he said, well, maybe it's time to get you up there and see what you think about this. I kept up the best I could, but it's a pretty fast-paced environment. Not a lot of sleep involved. Pretty rugged situation on 32-footers.
32-foot vessel. Is this a multi-day trip or...
So we usually arrive in the area into usually King Salmon, Alaska, or Dillingham, Alaska. Those are the hubs kind of that flank each side of Bristol Bay. We get there in like early mid-June typically. We do a week or two of boatyard work, get the boat kind of woken up from winter time. You know, the boats have to sit through some pretty harsh winters up there, and a boat's worst nightmare is not being used and just sitting. So there's always a surprise or two when we show up and something to fix and whatnot. By about the 20th of June, we get launched and go in the water. And so I fish on a drift boat, and it's a 32 footer with a net on board. And we go out, we set the net, we drift, we pick the fish out of the net, put the fish into holds. It's we're full living quarters. Inboard engines, and there are outboards out up there, and the outboards exist in the set net fishery, which is also an important part of the Bristol Bay fishery. It's beach based and camp oriented, where a set net crew will live in a cabin. They'll fish a length of net anchored to kind of across the tidal boundary, and when the tide comes in, the net floats and the net is fishing actively, and as the tide ebbs, the crew will go out and pick the net as the net goes dry, and they're using skiffs with outboards. So it's really just all sorts of different equipment and technology that go toward harvesting fish using a pretty old and tried and true method at the end of the day, which is just basic gill nets.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So you're setting a gill net and then coming back and picking it.
Yeah, that hasn't changed really at all. The net specifications and the type of nets and materials changed a little bit over the years, but really a gill net's a gill net. I'd say what has changed kind of on the back deck is fish quality. 30 years ago, my dad was pitching fish onto wooden scows with no refrigeration. Those fish were mostly serving a canned market. In the last 20 plus years, our 32 footers, most of them have refrigeration systems on board now. So we're putting our fish in refrigerated seawater, taking care of them on board in a way that decreases the chance that the fillet will be bruised or look ugly at the point of retail or distribution down the line. And many of the companies pay us extra now to carefully handle the fish on board.
It seems like, you know, having a really high quality product is a really great thing that you're able to do now with extensive refrigeration and all that kind of stuff. I've done some amount of work going out on commercial grouper boats and stuff off of our coast. And I'm always really impressed by the way that those guys can pack their hold. I mean, They're going out for a week or something like that, and they got to keep whole fish on ice, pack them just so to get them back to the dock in the best condition that they can.
Yeah, you can definitely see the difference in quality after a fish has been suspended, in our case, in 33-degree chilled seawater. It's a game changer. We hope that it continues to compelling market reality for us down the track, where as people see more of these bright, red, beautiful sockeye fillets at the grocery store and in other places, that ask from the consumer and the customer of quality at that end of the pipeline will keep the back pressure up the rest of the distribution chain all the way to the fishing boat, where we're, you know, seeing some of the benefits of taking care of our fish on board.
So I actually grew up in the Midwest, and my family isn't a water family really. And my mom to this day still says, "I don't like fish." And then we take her to one of the places that we know of, that we know who's landing the fish and where it came from and stuff. And she's like, "I love it. It's so good."
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yeah, because we take you to the fresh places, Mom.
You look at this country as compared to other countries, I'm thinking Asia in particular, and you look at the amount of seafood that hits the market here. There's a big disconnect at the point of retail, where the consumer doesn't know where his or her fish is really coming from. For work, I'm traveling out to the East Coast. I always like going to grocery stores and going to the seafood counter and looking at the labels and the ice picks and the different places where there's information about where these different species are coming from. I'm a total nerd that way. To look at what's there and how things are being marketed and how quality and origin and things are being communicated to the people who ultimately we rely on to eat our, what we think is an amazing protein that we're taking awfully good care of starting at the fishing boat. I was just out in Boston, took a trip up through Maine and New Brunswick, Nova Scotia for a couple of trade shows with the Logbook Company. And it was funny, I was joking with two of my colleagues I was traveling with and saying, we sure spend a lot of time talking about seafood and where it comes from rather than talk about logbooks and work. We're on these road trips and we just can't stop talking about fish and where the fish is coming from and who those fishermen are and who the distributors are and where all it had to travel to get to the place where we saw it in the supermarket. If you care about your food, no matter what else you're doing, the conversation sometimes leads back to that more often than not.
I think it's a problem in every realm of our food consumption, you know, I mean, and maybe in this moment, more people are thinking about where their food is coming from exactly. You know, everybody's starting gardens. I'd been meaning to start a garden for 5 years and I started one 2 months ago, right? It's so easy to just walk into the grocery store and pick up something and you don't have to know where it came from. But maybe more and more people are thinking about it now.
I can only hope.
In the Bristol Bay salmon harvest, I'm sure there are very strict controls on exactly what the harvest is and how that looks and everything like that.
Yes, the fishery, the stock is managed very tightly with a network of state biologists who are absolutely fantastic. As an aside here, just for a moment, one of the reasons I was looking forward to speaking with you on this podcast and along the lines of fishermen talking to scientists and scientists talking to fishermen is, I guess I kind of wanted to share the fact that where I come from in the Bristol Bay fishery, there is so much commingling between biologists and fishermen and processors and other constituents and stakeholders. I think it's a fantastic story to tell, and it's an important model for the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Now, fortunately, in the United States, I think there's a lot of opportunity to build bridges across those groups of people who at the end of the day care about fish. I did want to point out that, yeah, I'm on the phone multiple times directly to the area management biologist for the Naknek Quijack District in Bristol Bay. Seeing how his week's going, chatting with him, talking about what he sees on the horizon, what the rivers are looking like, what the lakes are looking like. I really appreciate that about our fishery and about other fisheries around the Alaska region, the Pacific region here. We are a limited entry fishery. There are 1,863 limited entry permits that are out on the market. Basically, all of them are owned, but some are not fished actively. Some can be, you can sell your limited entry permit on the open market and speculate on it if you want without ever buying a boat and going fishing. The market value of the permits rise and fall with the health of the industry. The state of Alaska didn't set the limited entry system up to allow for actual leases and transfers of permits on a lease basis. Rather, people lease permits in other ways through different types of transfers and working within the system that's there. Keep in mind that Bristol Bay is not a quota managed fishery at all. So we don't pre-own a slice of the pie like many other federally managed fisheries do. And I think we're probably one of the few derby fisheries left in the country. 40 million fish swim by us in a matter of like 3 to 4 weeks. And so it's not like halibut or crab where they sit on the bottom and you can simply opt to wait a week and wait out the bad weather and still go out and get them because they're going to be mostly in the same sort of spot.
That makes sense.
Salmon species in general, they're anadromous, right? They're moving from freshwater to saltwater and back again. And so when we harvest them, we're harvesting them as they're returning from sea and entering kind of that terminal watershed area where they're headed for freshwater habitat to spawn. If we miss them, we miss them. Like, they're gone. They've gone up the rivers. So it's very much a derby fishery. We listen to the radio at 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., and I think it's 8 p.m. every day, and fish and game based on escapement up the rivers and the projected total run and the daily harvest and the total harvest to date and all of these factors they take into account. They tell us whether we can go or not.
That's just incredible.
Yeah, it's pretty comprehensive for sure. I mean, there's dockside sampling that's going on all the time. There are all of the counting towers and weirs. I mean, think of people standing at counting towers with physical like counters in their hands, counting sockeye as they swim past the counting tower several miles up a particular river system. And that those numbers are getting extrapolated and reported back. All of these data points are coming in hour by hour by hour, and the biologists are making decisions on the fly like that. And it's not easy. And I take my hat off to the biologists because they're in very complicated positions with an industry on one hand that is relying on a fishing season to pay bills and a natural resource on the other hand that we're all there for the same reason, and not just next year, but 50 years from now.
Right.
And 100 years from now and beyond. And we typically fish the tide cycles. So in the district I predominantly fish in, we usually start any given period like 6 or 7 feet into the flood, fish through high water, fish a little bit of the ebb, and then usually the period is closed through low water for king salmon conservation. So
sorry, 6 or 7 feet into the flood. We get like 2 feet total.
Yeah, so we have anywhere from 18 to 30 foot tide swings up there.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And the current's racing at 3-4 knots. It's nuts.
If you were down at the bar after a trip and you were about to start a story with no shit, there I was, what would be coming after that?
There are a few, and most of them aren't very good from the standpoint of that was actually pretty serious and could have really sucked. But I'm standing here holding a beer and I can tell you about it and we're going to laugh about it. The tides and the currents and like the bathymetry of the bay, the fact that we're kind of fishing on this giant river delta that's meeting the ocean, it just makes for a really interesting navigational reality all the time. When there's fish and we're in them. It's a derby fishery, we're trying to catch as much as we can, as safely as we can, and get the fish in cold seawater delivered to the plant in the finest quality possible, trying to accomplish all these things in this really, really interesting and sometimes difficult environment. I mean, there's nothing worse than being in bad weather on an ebb tide in good fishing losing water underneath the boat because the, you know, the tide's dropping by several feet every hour and touching bottom. It's harrowing. 2 or 3 years ago, we were fishing out in the western part of Bristol Bay, which is notorious for big sandbars and changing sandbars too, right? Fishing was really good, and it was also happened to be like the storm of all storms for the season, and it was blowing like crazy, and we've basically been up for 20 plus hours. We had to stay up all night the night before to fix a circulation pump that had failed. Here we are, we're in fish, we're happy, we're good, but it is blowing, and we're trying to get the net out of a precarious situation in by the beach. We find out the hard way that there's a sandbar that is separating the deep water we're in near the beach and deep water out kind of where we need to go. We touch bottom, and we touch bottom really hard because we're on swells and the boat's got, you know, several thousand pounds of fish on it plus several thousand pounds of refrigerated seawater. You get in that situation and you quickly think about all the things that will go wrong in a matter of minutes, and boats roll over and they swamp in those conditions. And luckily there's enough horsepower below decks to where we basically dug a ditch like in this swell with the propeller to try and get over this sandbar and get off the sandbar. We wouldn't have made it. I mean, it would have been ugly. 6-7 foot rollers and the boat's leaning over because the keel's on the bottom and it's just ugly. And you're in the middle of nowhere, you know,
and you're right up on the beach.
Ugh. Yeah. And the Coast Guard station is the nearest one is in Kodiak, which is couple hundred, 300 miles away. And you know, you get out there and there's just not a lot you can do except fend for yourself and figure it out. Luckily that one turned out for the best, but Bristol Bay in particular, it's big water, big sky, it's big country, yeah, in big tides. And it's,
I'm glad that ended well. And that definitely puts my groundings in perspective. That trying to run the backwaters of Tampa Bay in a mullet skiff is the extent of my grounding situations.
if we could figure it out sometime, I'd love to come check out that part of the country. I've never been there before. And
I like a lot of things about it. Mullet skiff has the outboard in the front. It's about a third of the way back. Yeah. So that you can just run over these incredibly shallow 2-3 foot areas, and you have to just close your eyes and go for it sometimes.
Are those prop driven or are they jet outboards or?
They're props. You can pop okay. it sort of out of the water enough that you're not digging a trench through the grass.
Wow. Crazy. Yeah. I'd love to check that out sometime.
Yeah. But it's nothing in terms of the sheer sort of on your own of the Alaska coast.
Well, not much is, no matter where you come from.
You also got a master's degree in fisheries. Why did you decide to attend the University of Washington, and what made you decide to pick this particular degree?
When I graduated from undergrad back in 2009, that was obviously a poor time to be entering the job market. And I had an opportunity to go right to work at a marine supply store in Bellingham here. And I really didn't want to. I didn't want to go sit at a sales desk and tied to the man day in and day out, right? But I knew it was important, and the people that I would be interacting with every day in that setting were people I grew up with and respected. It was a good opportunity, got me kind of on my feet financially in my early mid 20s. And then by the time I was in my late kind of just turning 30, really, definitely wanted something more than that. And I always knew that there was a good chance I'd want to go back to school. And if I went back to school, I'd want to look at fisheries policy probably. And if I did all that, I'd probably want to do it at the University of Washington, because the University of Washington has such deep-rooted history in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences. Its policy program isn't nearly as old as the fishery science program, but has been around for a while now. It looked to be a fantastic place to spend a couple of years and learn up on U.S. fisheries policy and some surrounding issues that touch on science, touch on law, and other things. It's very much a multidisciplinary program. I was glad to kind of get out of that 20-something routine that I had going out of undergrad and try to further the intellectual capacity I wanted to have paired with my interest in fishing and my investment in fishing, frankly. Similar to being a rare being on this podcast, I was also kind of a rarer being in the School of Marine Affairs, because a lot of people were coming from the Coast Guard and the Navy back for education, a lot of folks out of undergrad, and a lot of folks coming from the hard sciences. mm-hmm. who wanted to kind of do the same thing I was doing, which was further their capacity on the policy side of things. And that kind of all goes back to the left hand talking to the right hand in that context. So
I'm about to turn 43 and I have a kid. It's definitely a thing to be not like everybody else. Yeah. But sometimes, you know, it gives you a lot of really good perspective that you can put to work within those programs, I find.
I've wrestled a bit with the idea, and I continue to wrestle with the idea of going back and getting a PhD, but I'm afraid to go step back into that sort of environment, I suppose, in academia, because frankly, I don't think I'm necessarily great at any one thing. I can do some things, I'm good at them, but you know, I'm no good at math. I never excelled at the hard sciences. I have a profound interest in these things, but on one hand, the School of Marine Affairs was multidisciplinary. We all knew it was, and it was no secret, and it was a strength of the School of Marine Affairs. But then when you look at maybe continuing that journey, does multidisciplinary work, and does it work in the fisheries sciences arena?
You know, one area in fisheries science that is really growing is sort of the sociology, because for decades, there's just been this split between the scientists who are keeping track of the fish and the fishers. And the scientists who are keeping track of the fish have really, up until very recently, felt like they didn't really have to understand anything about the fishers themselves. And in your fishery, you know, it's pretty unique that you have daily contact between all these different entities, right? I mean, and I think that kind of daily contact is really what breeds the kind of trust that you need within that setting.
Totally.
Whereas in a lot of other areas and a lot of other fisheries, you don't have a consistent contact between the people who are doing the fishing and the people who are looking at the numbers of fish and that kind of thing. And I think from, I don't know, research standpoint, people are finally realizing that, oh, you really do have to have these relationships, and you have to, you know, figure, understand what people want and what they're motivated by and what, you know, and gain their trust. I mean, that's one of the things that I think we're wrestling with in this moment from all angles, is mm-hmm. that for far too long, probably at least World War II, there's just been this very segregated idea of, you know, science is this separate thing that scientists do, and they're not real people and whatever. You know, when you can get people talking to each other and trusting each other, that's when you can really make the kind of strides that you need to make.
To wear my policy hat a little bit here, pulling straight from what I learned at the School of Marine Affairs, it seems like both on a federal level and on many state levels, that opportunity is there, at least. I mean, if you look at the federal councils and the council process, so long as the industry is willing to be involved and willing to dedicate the time to communicate with policymakers and with scientists, I mean, forum exists, and the forum exists in Alaska, you know, where I have most of my experience through the Board of Fisheries process, where anybody with a stake in Alaska fisheries can submit a proposal to the Board of Fisheries, have it heard, have it vetted by those who are appointed by the governor, and have a fair shot at directly influencing policy, you know, and therefore directly influencing the behavior of a fisherman in a fishery. And the implications downstream are far and wide. But how do we continue to bridge the gap?
So one more question about your master's. What do you think was the thing that surprised you the most?
I was really encouraged by the fact, and there are a lot of people in the younger demographic who really care about fisheries and care about the ocean and fisheries resources. And the fact that I could just show up one day at the School of Marine Affairs and start a 2-year journey in the master's degree and just have so much in common with so many people, when I otherwise thought, you know, when I was out in the working world and in my 20s selling, you know, fisheries equipment and boat parts, that it was just me who was interested in this stuff. And then all of a sudden you go into a very specialized field, working day in and day out with people who have the same sort of passion you do. A total breath of fresh air to be able to participate and have the opportunity to go surround myself with incredibly passionate people, both professors and colleagues all across the board, that want to dedicate their entire lives to making fisheries resources something that the public continues to have access to, industry has access to. And there were a million aha moments. Like that's why we go educate ourselves. One of my classes with a guy named Craig Allen, International Law of the Sea. Allen he's retired Coast Guard and he's been in the mix of helping work on and settle the disputes in the South China Sea. Yeah, I would come home energized most days from that program. The fact that these people exist and they're all in the same building and we can totally nerd out on fisheries policy and in fisheries science.
I definitely agree. Like the thing that really drove me back, I really, really miss like being in a world where everybody is like thinking about fish and thinking about research. So it's kind of comforting to like have those kind of people around you, I think.
How do you actually ask a research question? What is a bad research question? And what is an actionable question? So that was good for somebody like me who hadn't.
It's hard. It's so hard. I've spent time, you know, working with sort of high school students and early college students and stuff, trying to do some amount of research. And that's the thing that I think always trips people up is like, they're like, well, how did you come up with this question? And like, well, it's just sort of like a tiny continuation of somebody else's question. It's just that's kind of the next step that needs to happen.
The sheer number of professors and faculty at School of Marine and Environmental Affairs that I almost instantly just like looked up to and aspired to was amazing. You know, when you're in a field that you care about, that's specific, and you're not just surrounded by fellow students in that field, but you're surrounded by people who have and are dedicating their lives to it, and they're professors, and they're actively engaged in research year in and year out. And all of a sudden they're just like your colleagues, you know, and you have access to them, and they're also accessing you for what you know. And I had an idea of who I was going to be working with, but all of a sudden I'm working on a thesis question with somebody who's interested in fisheries economics issues and has a deep rooted interest in the specific question that I'm trying to drive out in the Bristol Bay sockeye fishery that I ultimately wrote my thesis on.
And your wife is also a commercial fisherman and you have a small child as well. How do you make it work?
I'm not sure. Do you have any suggestions?
I just haven't been on the water in like 2 years.
Well, unfortunately, that's kind of what it's looking like for Carly, my wife. She didn't go fishing last year and it's not looking like she's going to fish this year. She may go up for a week or two toward the end of the season, but COVID is of course really impacting the whole thing too. So it's a moving target, but eventually we'd like to incorporate the entire family into the fishing operation and raise our daughter on the water as much as she wants to.
So your current project that you're working with is the Deckhand Logbook software. What got you into this project?
What got me into the project specifically was through a side interest of mine in thinking about low barrier ways. We're talking low cost, easy to access ways that fishermen can collect data on board their vessels. Don't get me wrong, fishermen collect data all the time on board their fishing vessels. They're using their own logbooks. They're reporting to fishery managers. They're constantly watching, you know, all of their systems and maintenance records, and the sky's the limit. But can we use phones and tablets and those sorts of tools that we all are carrying around every day, most of us, to enhance not only fishermen's awareness of what's going on in the environment around them from a data standpoint, but for the purposes of potentially sharing some of that data with either their buddies or the science community or fishing associations, that maybe there's a group of vessels that want to share particular data. There has to be a way to actually create the 21st century logbook where the focus is on fishermen owning their own data, but that data, which is going to be reported anyway on logbooks or fish tickets, or the data they elect to share with others, is totally open for managing in whatever way fishermen want. So the company was founded in Australia and has been around for about a decade in a few fisheries in the state of South Australia specifically. The logbook was deployed last summer, our summer, in New Zealand across over 30 gear types, mostly for new regulations that came out of the New Zealand government. And we're trying to roll it out here in the U.S. for the same reasons. But let me just say, I'm interested in hearing from the scientific community as well. Like, what are your data needs? What data are you missing from the field? I mean, look, we're building a logbook that is built by fishermen for fishermen. We want to give fishermen an experience using an electronic logbook that isn't intended for regulators, isn't intended for specifically the mandatory requirement of electronic reporting. We want fishermen to use a logbook that they actually enjoy using to collect any data they want to collect. The possibilities are endless with how that data is used. And I'll say first and foremost that the data fishermen collect is always their own data and it's only used with the fisherman's permission. But if a fisherman chose to share data with the scientific community, because as we've been talking about earlier in this podcast, it's important to come up with ways to constantly bridge the gap in communication between these different users and scientists, would scientists find, you know, a sort of data sharing useful coming from fishermen specifically? We have received really positive response from some scientists. We've presented to industry associations on several occasions, and specifically up in the Bering Sea, we've spoken with industry and with NOAA Fisheries. Some of the scientists with NOAA Fisheries who are relying on trawl surveys that occur once a year. But it seems like there's all those things are expensive and there's always a need for more data. So what can fishermen do to reach out to the scientific community from a communication standpoint, but also from a, if they have access to this technology and they can collect data, would that help? You know, would high resolution data help from the thousands of people that are out on the water?
I think that's a really, really good question. And I think that in general, the answer would be absolutely. It does seem like a good opportunity to have something that the fishermen want to fill out, you know, for their own records and then be able to share as a win for everybody and a positive for everyone. Alaska fisheries are well known as being some of the highest amount of coverage for observers of any fishery in the country. And, you know, some of the high value fisheries in Alaska is like 200%, right? You have two observers on every single vessel. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, a lot of the commercial fisheries are covered at like 2%, 5%, yeah, something like that. So most of the fishing is not actually being captured. Our commercial grouper and snapper anyway have vessel monitoring systems and that sort of thing, but that can only get you so far, right? That can get you where they went. It's not giving you much more in terms of, you know, what happened once they got there. A lot of guys resent it because they have to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what we're trying to get away from. When our logbook got started in South Australia, fishermen actually enjoyed using it. Fishermen were required to report their daily activity on logbooks. The government even put together a state-funded logbook system that was available for free to fishermen. But fishermen opted to pay for the deckhand logbook simply because the user interface was so much more smooth. The data that it was able to feed back to them was valuable just to their own businesses, mm-hmm. and it took care of their reporting requirements. To pivot away from what is required from a reporting and a tracking standpoint and kind of go back to basics here and make it about fishermen that are the ones using the water and harvesting these resources and in the closest contact with the environment as sources of some of this data and kind of the eyes on the ground of, in terms of what's going on, I think is there's a lot of room for discussion around that topic. I'll give you an interesting example. And in the Bering Sea specifically, because of climate change, the cod stock has moved north quite a ways. One thing that's going on is that the cod are eating juvenile Opelio crab. So some of the stock assessments on Opelio crab in the Northern Bering Sea are looking a little bit different, and folks are trying to figure out why. And when you have a cod that comes up in a trawl survey and you open the belly up of a cod and you find a bunch of like, you know, dollar coin sized Opelio crab in the belly of a cod, that raises some pretty serious questions about not just climate change, but food chain implications of climate change and how it's going to affect a really important fishery. what if instead of relying on that one trawl survey to see that and to witness that, we relied on basically every opportunity that there was when a cod came up in an Opelio crab pot. If a fisherman could observe that and somehow just jot it down on an iPad, and the next time that iPad saw a Wi-Fi or a cellular network, it could send it off to nymphs or something like that. And all of a sudden you'd have 60 boats or 80 boats looking at those data points and observing those things and just making notes of them. It's not peer-reviewed science, but it's citizen science. And I think there's something to be said for that higher resolution kind of citizen science approach.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that a lot of people are really thinking about moving in that direction into how can we get as many people producing as high quality of data as possible? Because that's one of the other problems that people have with, I think, a lot of citizen science projects is that on the front end, you have to think very carefully about how you're asking the questions so that you can get the most consistent data possible. And it's not that you can't do it. It's just that you have to design it well enough to get what you're actually looking for or be flexible enough on the back end. Do you think that sort of smartphone and tablet kind of tools are things that fishermen of all ages and generations and stuff are using on a consistent basis?
I do. Most fishermen, I would argue, have smartphones with them on board to call home, right? Mm. And to text and to do the basic things that we all do. But increasingly you see apps like Navionics out there for purchase, for download and for purchase, where a fisherman, instead of buying a $4,000 Garmin GPS, he or she could buy a $400 iPad, if that, download a Navionics with US charts for $50, and you have a chart plotter, like fully end-to-end chart plotting solution that replaces the super expensive Garmins and Helm electronics on the boat. And I just think that being able to utilize those tools, it liberates people when it comes to kind of integrating their operations and making things more efficient on board. And that we have, there's a story we tell and to others who are interested in deckhand. There are fishermen we actually helped not retire because they were so fed up with the arduous nature of the paper-based reporting that they were required to do. And then they started using deckhand and they said, gosh, you know, I'm going to revisit this whole retirement thing. I'm an old salt. Like, I'm ready to be done, but I'm just sick of the paperwork. But if there's something like there apparently is here with deckhand that makes reporting super easy and makes my entry of the pots I haul for rock lobster and what's in those pots and target catch and bycatch and those things, if it's really this easy, then gosh, that makes me reevaluate my career. And that if the technology was really going in this direction, then things were being made easier for sure. Make the back end and kind of the engine behind it super powerful. We're integrating right now with Greater Atlantic. So fishermen here in the next couple of months will be able to use our product and submit their vessel trip reports. At the end of the day, the reporting is only one component of an otherwise very like complex mindset that I can speak to personally. Like, I'm always thinking about all the different things going on my boat and all the things I need to write down and remember. And if we can kind of get out of the 20th, 19th century, create an app that works for people in that way, also takes care of reporting and maybe some science along the way, that could be a win for everybody. So
there's something so poetic about that hard-backed book on your table, though.
There is. I know. Yeah. Maybe the next thing we should do is manufacture a super nautical leather-bound iPad cover, and you can just close it up at the end of the day when you've dropped the anchor. And
so this is geared primarily towards commercial fishermen, right? Who are already logging a lot of stuff and, like you said, like keeping track of all their fuel consumption and the tides and everything else. Have you looked at it in a recreational context at all?
Absolutely. We don't have a recreational version of Deckhand out at this point, but especially in the area of the country that you're in, seems like recreational fishing, charter fishing, headboat, those operators, pretty serious contenders in the industry down in the Gulf and in the South Atlantic.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I looked into that, and I understand that's a big deal. And recreational fishing is a big deal out here, out west as well, of course. We've talked to some charter operators. We've talked to some recreational fishermen. We know that that's where the app needs to head. I guess it's just that the app's roots are originally in the commercial fishery. There's some regulation changes right now in different parts of the country that really dovetail nicely with our rollout here in North America on the commercial side. But yeah, we would love to get Deckhand in the hands of charter operators, recreational fishermen. We think it would be a really user-friendly tool for those folks. It would get rid of paper. It would bring, you know, basically the entire business aspect of it into kind of an integrated user interface, and hopefully be a powerful tool for recreational users and commercial fishermen alike.
So one of the things that they've been working on for several years is actually in some of the fisheries splitting out the for hire sector from the recreational sector, because traditionally it's been just a part of the recreational sector, but they realize that it's actually a very different fishery than, you know, truly recreational guy going out on his boat with his buddies or whatever. And it's something totally different from a commercial fishery. So they're really working on how exactly to allocate them, you know, their own basically slice of the pie.
I'm always careful to not speak too loosely about like the for hire sector, the charter headboat sector, because they're commercial enterprises as well. They're businesses that rely on catching fish. I think we have to definitely remember who's making a living doing this.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the reasons and the main impetuses for this, you know, three-way split now is that, so traditionally the for hire sector had been rolled in with the recreational sector, but the problem was that when you start to tighten tax, when you ratchet down on total catches, and you still have somewhat of a derby style with a bunch of people whose livelihoods are relying on it rolled into it, it's pretty hard on their business. And so get their own piece in and have sort of, I think they're working towards their own sort of IFQ, you know, that then they can decide their allocation of effort and stuff like that.
Yeah. There are equity implications there. It seems, and similar efforts are taking place in the Alaska Gulf of Alaska halibut fishery. There are some different entities that are trying to get around the same table from a quota standpoint as the commercial users are, the commercial fishermen are, so recreational charter operators. And even there's even been the idea of crew. And that brings up a whole other topic surrounding barrier to entry. There are barrier to entry concerns in some of these commercial fisheries that have seen increases in the cost of quota and capital boats, all those sorts of things. And if you've been crewing for 10 years on a halibut boat and in the state of Alaska, maybe there should be a crew slice of the pie there too. All these
conversations. The topic is endless.
It is. Yeah, we could go on for hours on that one.
Do you have other things that you think about besides fishing?
Yeah, of course.
Because a lot of us don't really.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're fairly new parents, and that's bringing in an entire different mindset now. Of course, being a part of the Deckhand Logbook North American entity here and working with the Australians is a learning experience all in and of itself. Learning as we go about the implications and constraints and challenges and opportunities, I guess, around the whole like international business setting. We live on Slack. We live and breathe the Australia time zones, and Australia does the same for us. Running a company that exists on both sides of the mighty Pacific has been very consuming as well, and lots to think about there. That doesn't get us completely away from fishing. We enjoy playing in the mountains here in Washington, and we actually, when I was at the UW at School of Marine Affairs, I lived on a sailboat on Lake Union. My wife and I bought a sailboat, and I lived on it in Lake Union, and we decided to keep it. We are fixing it up and doing some things to it. Hopefully in time for summer to get our little girl out on the water a little bit. Also starting the garden out here and all that too.
So I'm just going to ask you my final three questions. This one might not pertain exactly to you, but I find it highly entertaining. Some biologists have suggested that you're not a real scientist unless you have your study species tattooed on your body somewhere. So my question is always, do you have any fish tattoos?
No, I do not. Does this mean I need to tattoo a sockeye salmon on my arm?
I mean, you might think about it. A salmon fillet, a salmon steak.
Ooh, I like the idea of a fillet, actually.
What's your dream job or location?
I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up, and I don't anticipate that I ever will. So that makes the response to this question a little bit challenging, but I figure that if things, you know, go south, being a bush pilot in Alaska somewhere and having a nice cabin on the river to come home to wouldn't be half bad.
And finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Humility is top of mind right now. I think about everything going on currently with the pandemic and think about that, but then I think about being a steward of the resource so I can ensure that 50 plus, 100 plus years from now, our resource will still be intact for future generations to enjoy. It all requires a bit of humility and pause. And if everybody had a little bit of a dose of that, dealing with the challenges of our current circumstances or in fisheries or respecting our natural resources, I think humility, you can't have too much of it.
Lang, thank you so much for being here. If people want to connect with you online, where could they find you again?
They can find me on Twitter. I'm an amateur Twitter user at Lang Solberg. And I'm also on Facebook. And you can find me through our website, deckhandlogbook.com.
Thank you to everybody for listening. I want to remind everyone that we now have a Patreon page for the show. So if you feel so inclined, head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast and check it out. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fishvecchio. The podcast is Fisheries Pod. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the show. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Fisheries Podcast. And remember, stay humble. Say hi, Lang.
Hi. Is it Joseph?
Hi, Lang.
Hello. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to help Mom.